Good evening. My name's Kristen, and I'm an alcoholic. Just a few things to, I guess, qualify myself. Because 2 hours of driving doesn't. What's the sobriety date? It's April 27th, 2008. Sorry. Lost track for a second. I have a home group. It's the Outlaw Safecracker Group. We meet Mondays and Thursdays in Richmond. And if anybody's down that way tomorrow, we're actually having our 7th anniversary dinner, which we'd like to invite everybody to come to. I have a sponsor. I spoke to her today. And she has a sponsor, and I sponsor women. So I am, at the end of my drinking, I was a morning drinker. I was a maintenance drinker. I was a binge drinker. I was a whatever you want to call it. I was absolutely everything. And, you know, it wasn't that way the whole time for me. Actually, drinking was quite enjoyable for quite a period of time for me. And if I could do it in the same way, then I would still be doing it. But I don't miss the way that it ended and the way that it had gotten. So, I was born and raised in Virginia Beach, Virginia, obviously. And I'm an only child. So, you know, a lot of people are like, only child. I don't know any different. So, you know, I'm an only child, and I grew up with a good family. Mom and dad both worked. Middle-class family. I didn't really need for anything or want for anything. And I used to always get accused of having everything by my friends, but the whole thing is I was like, well, you have a brother and sister. You have the same exact thing that I have. I just don't have to share it. And it's true, you know, but at a very young age, my mother wanted me to be socialized. She knew the only child syndrome. So she put me in preschool, too, and she went back to work. I was fine all through preschool, all through, you know, I still have my first memory, I remember, that actually came back to me when I was, like, 2 years sober. It was really cool. I grew up with my family, the only child, and went ahead and went to elementary school. That's when things started to change a little bit for me. I have heels on, but I'm 5'4", and I was 5'4" in the fourth grade, and I stopped growing. So, you know, everybody was like, "Oh my gosh, she's going to be a great basketball player," you know, and everything, and you know that also starts with part of my problem of not being able to accept where I am at the moment, because everybody was like, oh, she's going to be, and I was like, oh, I'm going to be, and so I did. I started playing sports, but I didn't feel awkward and out of place, because absolutely, I was the tallest person, even out of boys, I was the tallest person, and they line you up for the pictures, and they would always do it by height. It was just horrible and awkward, and I wasn't very small framed either, and I was a fat kid before, and then I grew up and spread out, I guess, and so I did. I started playing sports, and that was what I was good at, and my parents supported me. I always felt the need to be my father's son and my father's daughter, because I was the only child, and you know, it made me happy to please him, and it made me happy. My mom was always very easy to please, and she's just delightful. I always just felt that I constantly needed to please my father. My father, as I got older, he suffers from a mental illness as well, and just didn't want to acknowledge it. So he was physically in my life, but emotionally, he was pretty checked out. So it was basically my mom and I that were very close when I was growing up. I started to have different things go wrong with most people don't. When I was 11, I started having knee surgeries. Probably because I was so tall at 11, I don't know. But I ended up having some knee surgeries, and that, you know, it was just a whole series of things that kind of, I wasn't the kid that was outside riding a bike, you know, and playing with Barbie dolls. It was awkward. So I'm in elementary school. I'm pretty rebellious. I love to lie. I lie sober. I mean, it just, like, I have to stop myself sometimes, and I'm just like, I mean, I'm talking little lies, I'm talking huge lies. You know, if I'm not, you know, spiritually fit on a daily basis, I will go back to my old ways even without the alcohol, because alcohol is just a symptom. But I would lie, and I'm an only child. So, you know, if somebody writes on the wall, I try to lie about it, you know, and I, so it must have been like a really, really bad lie. So I remember one time we were at a church, and I was a kid, and we were prank dialing 911. And that was like a huge big deal when you were a kid, because they would call back. And you were like, how did that happen? And there was one other girl that was with me, and I just point blank with this girl standing right next to me just lied to my father and said she did it. You know, I mean, just nothing stood in my way. I was fearful of absolutely everything. I was fearful of being wrong. I was fearful of being corrected. I was fearful of being punished. And I didn't come from a violent family or anything, you know. It was just, I was just scared. I got in trouble at early age for doing stupid stuff. I got caught kissing on the playground when I was in elementary school. So my parents had to be right at the beginning, like, oh my gosh, here we go. And so, you know, I was intelligent as well. So when I was getting ready to go on to middle school, the series of events and the way that it happened, when I was in elementary school, people would be like, okay, you don't fit in. Kristen's unhappy. So we just wait till you get to middle school. You know, just wait, because then you'll be around people that are older and it's different and to change. Once I was in middle school, I was absolutely miserable. And then everybody's like, just wait till you get to high school. You just have to get out of middle school. Middle school is horrible. You know, and then I got to high school, and they were just like, just wait till you can go away to college. You know, I mean, not realizing that wherever I went, there I was. And that started happening, I started manipulating some things at a quite a young age. I spent 1 year at middle school, and it just wasn't working, so I did the geographical cure for middle school and switched schools. Same thing in high school. My senior year, I went to the same high school for 3 years. My fourth year, my senior year, I'll get to that in my story, but I had a pretty rough senior year. And second day of school, I was not getting up out of bed. And my mom's like, we're not doing this. So she switched schools. She made me switch schools. And that was fine with me. It was perfectly fine with me, because I was running from whatever I had going on at that school, and it could go to a new one. So it all started. I believe that I was born an alcoholic. That's just me. Some of the things that I look back on, I see that I did alcoholically before I even put a drink in my body. My grandparents are alcoholics. Neither one of my parents are. So if you want to, I think it does have something to do in the chain, but, you know, my parents were good parents, with a difficult child. My mom was, and another thing is, too, is that I never did anything. Well, I did do some huge things wrong, but I always made it home on time for curfew. You know, I never missed the bus. I never, you know, I did my chores. I did everything like that. But when I went bad, I went bad. And, you know, so my mom's a high school guidance counselor. And my father worked very closely with individuals in the high school. So he helped the football team. And he would videotape them and send them off to scouts, you know, or colleges for the guys that were getting ready to go. So we knew all of the football coaches. From a very young age, all of the football coaches would come over to our house after the football games. And, you know, they would drink. Now, I don't remember anything crazy ever really happening, but I did see things like there was a coach that was leaving, and he was actually coming up to Richmond because he had gone to U of R, and he was coming back up to visit. So he had filled a trash bag up with beer, because he was taking it for the ride. You know, this was in the 80s, and, you know, I mean, it wasn't like DUIs are so, I mean, it wasn't the same. And so, you know, he would get in, and I just remember my mom saying, you just be careful, you know, as he got in the car. So, you know, I saw these things. There was alcohol in our house. I don't recall my parents ever drinking, you know, obsessively or... we had a wet bar, which I got into trouble with because I would just drink it when they had gone to bed. But I had also started to, as an only child and wanting to please everybody, started to become very anxious at a very young age of trying to please everybody. And I ended up starting to work when I was 13 years old, and I highly do not recommend this for anybody that has kids, but I started working at a restaurant. And in Virginia Beach, I worked down at the oceanfront. My two cousins worked with me, and they're 10 years older than me, and they were supposed to take care of me. It's not their responsibility to take care of their little cousin. But I started bussing tables at this one restaurant, and I was responsible. You know, I was responsible. I went to work. I had my own money. and then I started to realize that along with this work, came pleasure with working in a restaurant as well. And mind you, I'm 13, but I probably look like I'm 17. So that just causes for a big mess. So I end up going out on a group outing with the people that are working with me, and we take a charter bus to a concert. I went to go see Hootie and the Blowfish. And this is where my first drink takes place. And so I'm getting off the bus. Well, they had kegs on the bus, so we were all going out. And I don't know, people just thought, oh, 13-year-old's not going to drink, 14-year-old. And I did. And I had my one cousin that was always wanted her approval as well. And she's 12 years older than me, and she's never liked me. And she was always the cool older one. You know, in the 80s, she was the one that drove my little cousin around, and she smoked cigarettes and all this stuff. And so I guess in a way I looked up to her, but she could not stand me. She couldn't stand me. So we're on this bus, and she happens to be on this trip with us. It's me and another friend. And, you know, I start drinking, and first off, the drinking part was like a big sigh of relief. And I chased that sigh of relief every single day when I came home from work. And I chased it until my last drunk. I got a little bit of what that was, but nothing like the first time. So I was feeling pretty good. And my cousin was there, and she turns around, she starts being real cool with me. And she starts saying, like, you know what, you're really cool, you know, and you're really awesome, and you're fun to be with. And, you know, just right there, okay, so I get the sense of aha and relief, and then I'm fitting in as well. So what is there not to like about this stuff I'm drinking, you know? And I probably did this, and I probably experimented just like any other teenager did, except that, you know, later on in life, if I had alcoholism, it's progressive. And I soon became mentally obsessed with a drink, or I should say with escaping. Drugs are part of my story. I don't usually go into great details about them, but they are. And usually when I did do drugs, they were to enhance the drinking. So I was working, and, you know, I started partying. It wasn't like I went out and got drunk immediately right after that again. You know, I got sick that night and woke up on my cousin's floor. I mean, and you know, it wasn't like, oh, I had to go do that again. But when I did get the opportunity to, I did. And by the time I was 16, 17 years old and driving, I was partying on a regular basis, first on the weekends and then whenever I could. So I was still playing sports, and, you know, alcohol and drugs really started to my actions. I had things removed in my life. I was black or white. I could either do something really, really well or just do absolutely nothing and not do, you know, or I not care. So if I were to practice, and I had scholarships, too, to play basketball and soccer, if I were to practice, it would have been all in, all or nothing, or absolutely nothing. And so I started doing the absolute nothing because it was much easier to get the satisfaction from doing this or doing this than, you know, actually working really hard for grades and for sports. So I chose to go the easy way, the easiest way for me to relieve anything that I was feeling. I bounced around from groups to groups when I was in high school. I mean, I wasn't in one particular group because I didn't feel like I fit in. I try not to put too much emphasis on that because everybody always says that, but it's true. It's just, so I never fit in. I never felt like I fit in until I walked into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. Until I started becoming involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had some emotional issues and some, I guess they call them, biochemical issues now. And with the steps and with me following through what I need to do, you know, I'm a pretty sane person on a daily basis. When I was a teenager, not so much. I drank to escape. I did drugs to escape. I was not defiant. Like I said, I would come home, curfew, perfectly fine. I would work. You know, I would keep my own money. I went out one night and ended up getting a DUI when I was 16 years old. I was coming back from a party. I mean, no great details. I was coming back from a party and I got pulled over. I didn't suffer or have any consequences from this in the long run. I got off with the charge. The police officer happened to be new, and he forgot to call in the magistrate. And it was still at the time and day in Virginia Beach that the cop would take you home. So my dad was out of town. My mom decided not to tell him. That was another thing about our family. We looked real pretty on the outside, but we swept a lot of things under the rug. And there was just, there was a lot of emotional chaos in my family. Nothing physical or anything like that, but there was just a lot of unstable individuals in the house. So I got this DUI when I was 16 years old, and the first thing and the only thing I can really think to do to relieve it is to drink. So I didn't stop. Most people that don't have what I have and what we have are like, oh my God, I'm never going to do that again. You know, that just cost my parents X amount of money for a lawyer, you know, and all of this stuff. And I did not pay for that lawyer either. And, you know, but I went right back out and drank. I continued to drink, you know, on a weekend basis. I continued to mix some of the prescription drugs that I was on with drinking as well, which is not good. Another thing is that, you know, I was diagnosed with depression, and if you take your medicine and you try to drink, it doesn't really work. So for years and years and years, I was taking medicine, and I had no idea it had any effect on my body whatsoever, because they were canceling each other out. And so by the end of it, and I don't really need to go into great detail, I ended up having 3 DUIs before I was 18 years old. That was my, when I was 16 years old. When I was 17, in December of whatever year that was, I was coming home from out of town and had some people in my car, and someone jerked my wheel, and my car flipped over. And it flipped over about 8 times and landed upside down on the interstate. My parents were coming back from a Christmas party that evening, and their friends called them and said, don't go this way because there's a really bad car accident, and there's absolutely no way anybody survived in that car accident. All 3 of us survived, and that was my car, and they didn't know it. So my parents went to the hospital, and they didn't find this out until probably a week later, until they were talking to the couple that they were talking to, that was me. I mean, they could see the damage of the car and everything like that, but alcohol easily could have killed me that night, but I also think alcohol saved me as well, because I really think that if I took this limp, it goes limp for a reason. So I did that, and then a week later, you know, I dealt with every issue that I ever had with drinking. So I drank again, and I got pulled over. And I did end up losing my license for a year. And Virginia Beach is a very large city. From one end to the next, well, with traffic, can take you longer than an hour now. But back then, it would take you about 45 minutes to an hour. So I grew up in the western part, and I would commute down to work at the oceanfront. So when I was old enough and my license was taken away, I just moved down to the oceanfront and started working down there. And, you know, I just started ripping and running. I was didn't have a license. Didn't really care if I didn't have a license. I had graduated from high school, barely graduated from high school. All of my scholarships had been taken away from me, mainly because of my GPA. I almost did not. I mean, it came down to, like, the morning of graduation, that I didn't know if I was going to be walking across the stage or not. And mind you, my mom and dad are both in education, so this is like a nightmare for them. I ended up graduating. I moved down to the oceanfront. I started working at a restaurant, and I also started working at a bar. So that was just late hours. But it was fun. It was fun for me because I could do what I wanted to do, and that was drink. And I could also work, and I could drink after hours. In that situation, I was 19 or 20, I guess. But I started doing, there were other drugs that were introduced to me, and they were in my life for quite a few years. But like I said, I always ended up doing drugs so that I could always drink more, and it enhanced them, and it would be horrible. I mean, I would be on day benders with drinking, and hardly any sleep. And, you know, I don't know. I think my parents, 3 DUIs and all of this, and I think my parents just chose to be naive because they were afraid to look at what was really going on. They enabled me quite a bit. And, you know, I'm extremely grateful for what they did, but still at the same time, I can't ever go back and say the shoulds, but maybe it would have been different if I would have had to start manning up and doing my own stuff. So I did graduate from high school. I took a year off, and then I started going to community college. Somehow, some way, I kicked butt in school and college. I have no idea. Well, I don't know what happened. I guess I became responsible. And the real world scared me. The real world scared me where I was, and I think it was what I needed to do for the situation I was in at that time. Luckily, that went well for me, and I ended up, I was actually dating the owner of a bar down at the oceanfront because my philosophy is, you know, why deal with the middleman? And so we, of course, thought that we were just, you know, hot stuff being down there and he in the bar and then there I was. And so we got in free to places and drinks and all that stuff. So that was my life for a while. And I thought it was glamorous. And really when I look back at it, it was quite pathetic. I worked for my dad. He worked for a company that provided caps and gowns and class rings for people down in our area. And so that was kind of a cush job. If anybody knew that I was hungover, they didn't say anything. I'd come in when I want to, I'd work, whatever. So I ended up, my relationship ended up failing, and it actually ended up failing because I was accusing him of being a drug addict, and he just did things that I didn't do. And so I left, and I was supposed to be marrying this person. And it's a blessing that I didn't. So I moved back in with my parents, and you know, the first thing my dad does is he pours me a drink and he offers me a drink because he doesn't realize what I'm like and he wants to take the pain away from his daughter and he just thinks that this is what's going to happen. I ended up from there, I transferred and I went to Old Dominion University and, you know, I was not happy. I was never happy. So I wanted to try to get as far away as I possibly could but with the safety net of being able to come back home. So they have study abroad programs. So I happened to go, I had the opportunity to go overseas and study in England. And in true fashion, that I never like to follow rules or direct, well, some, but directions, I ended up going for one semester, but I ended up staying for about 2 years. I did come home for the holidays, but, you know, they drank like I did over there, or at least they did at first. You know, I was going to school, but your instructors and your professors would drink with you before you went to class. They would drink with you after class. You know, drinking is accepted in their society, and it's not looked down upon to a certain point. I, like it says in the book, I was a tornado. I ripped through people's lives that were over there. I brought back a hostage. Well, I like to call him a hostage because, bless his heart, he didn't have any where to go, but I guess he was in America, so he was happy. But my boyfriend from over there came over and stayed with me for a little while, and then one day I decided that I just didn't want to be in a relationship anymore, so he was about ready to get on the plane in London to come over to America for the summer, and I just called him up and said, don't come, and that I was done. You know, I had no idea what I was doing with other people's lives. And it was all about me. And I was worried that he wouldn't understand that I went back to that same restaurant I was working in when I was 13. And I had started waiting tables and bartending. And I knew that he wouldn't understand the way that I was in that environment. And so I was like, then something's got to give and it's not going to be that environment. So I come back home. I'm living at home. And I have one more semester left. At this time, I had started drinking very, very, very heavily, and I would do things like hide the alcohol in my closet in my parents' house, where I was living, and I was way over drinking age, and they knew I drank, but I felt the need because I drank in such excess that I had to hide it. I would do things like drink the vodka that was in the freezer, and I would fill it back up with water, and I would put it back in the freezer, and here comes the lying part. I would tell them that their bottle was defective, and they needed to go take it back to the ABC store. Because obviously something was wrong with that vodka because it's freezing, you know? And I was thinking, that they were buying this. And we laugh about it now. But, you know, at the time, that's how sick I was. I almost burnt my parents' house down while they were away one time. And I didn't even know it. I was home and they were out, you know, they thought they could leave their responsible 25-year-old daughter, you know, in the house. And I woke up, and there was a drawer that was, like, burnt down. And I have no idea. I still, to this day, have no idea how that happened, what happened in the drawer, anything. So, you know, things like that I started becoming careless with. I ended up graduating with my bachelor's degree, and a degree that I knew that I was not going to be able to work with without getting a master's. So I knew to continue my education. I knew I had to continue my education. When I was in school as well, in each school I went to, every single member of my family is like dead to a professor, because that was my excuse. There was always a funeral. There was always a funeral. Somebody was always dying. They're not dead. I didn't feel like taking the test, you know? And it's really, it got ridiculous, and I started running out of people, you know? I was, like, down to my father, and I'm like, oh, I can't do my father, because if they run into me one time or something, but this is how bad, and that's my disease talking to me. And I still, to this day, will get into situations that I can either lie or, you know, tell the truth. And so I go into grad school. My whole family's dead. It's my undergrad. So I go into grad school, and, you know, I'm like, this is a new open chapter, a new open book. I move away from Virginia Beach. I move up to Richmond, and I'm living by myself. And I'm living in the Fan, if any of you are familiar with Richmond. And a lot of people say, oh, the Fan. And, you know, it's really sad, because the Fan can be a city can be an actual, very lonely place when you're an alcoholic hitting your bottom. I hit my bottom when I was in Richmond. I had fun while I was drinking. I could drink big guys under the table, you know, and I was fun and I was humorous and people wanted to hang around with me. And then all of a sudden it was like I hit a wall. And, you know, it was like all of a sudden I was waking up and I was in the middle of a bar floor and I had no idea how I got there and what I was doing. You know, I'd been born and raised in Virginia Beach, and people were saying, you're not allowed to come in here anymore. I would just start crying for no reason whatsoever, because the song was on, and it made me start to cry. I don't know. It was just really weird how it happened, but it happened, and it happened fast. And that's when I just started drinking alone. You know, not thinking, oh, I may have a problem, or, you know, this can't continue. I mean, most people, when they come to or they have a blackout, they're scared to death. You know, I was just happy because I was closer to a paycheck, you know, but I didn't have to go through those 3 days. I don't remember them. I just know the money was in the bank. And so I moved up to Richmond, and that's where I became a very isolated drinker. And I happened to have a degree that requires a lot of social skills. And so it was very interesting trying to go through this program with a drinking problem. I got my first real career job when I was there, and I also had it taken away from me. I didn't drink on the job, but I also was not reliable in my job. So by the third time of me not being reliable for my job, my boss calling me in there saying, you can either resign or we can fire you. And so I chose to resign. And I was actually working for the university at that time, and they were paying for my school. So that was a big blow. To me. But the first thing I did was go to an ABC store. When I moved up to Richmond, I would go into a different store every day, different ABC store, because I didn't want them to remember me from the night before or from the day before. You know, I mean, who cares, really? But, you know, that's what I did. I had it mapped out, you know, and then sometimes I'd forget. And I would end up in the same one. And, you know, it's just sad, some of the things that I did. Anywhere that I drove, I had a drink in my car. You know, if I would have been making this trip up here and not in recovery, I would have had a drink in my car. It was sad. I became very depressed. And finally, I had one friend in my graduate program. And finally, she came to me and she was like, "Kristen, people are talking about you." And I was clueless. I was like, "What are you talking about?" She's like, "You smell." She's like, "You smell, and people in our classes are becoming aware of it." And she's like, and it's true. I had a good reason to smell. I drank on the way to school. When we had a 20-minute break in our class, I would go out to my car and I would drink. It's really sad when I talk about this now because how much alcohol consumed my life. but she, her father was in recovery, or I think he still is. And I always laugh because she's an Al-Anon. So, of course, she was coming to me to help me. And so she was telling me this, and I don't know what it was. Things had started getting really bad. You know, I started actually getting violent when I was drinking. I was dating someone, and I was getting violent towards them, which is not like me at all. And I can't believe that I was violent. so, you know, a lot of things just weren't working for me. So she pulls out all of these pamphlets from AA, and she's like, "Good, I'm glad you said that, you know, that you're accepting to this." And I was just like, "Well," and I said, "And if I wasn't," she's like, "I still would have pulled them out and given them to you." So, you know, that was kind of my first encounter of AA. That, and I happened to be in a drug and alcohol class that semester, and it required me to go to a meeting, which was very odd. So I go to a meeting, and maybe a seed was planted. I'm not quite sure. I didn't stay sober. There were probably about 4 men in this program that I went into, and I think that there was an Al-Anon meeting upstairs, so I think their wives were up there, so it was kind of a you go, I go sort of deal. And I started drinking. I was traveling out of state, and I ended up 10 years before I had my last DUI. 10 years later, I ended up getting pulled over in North Carolina, and I got my fourth DUI. Mind you, my other ones are not on my record because I'm under 18. I was under 18 when I got them. And at that point in time, I was like, okay, maybe I have a problem. Just maybe. So I ended up going in to cover my butt into an IOP because that's what looks good. And I go into this IOP, and, of course, I'm product of my family all put together on the outside in this big basket case on the inside. And I go into this, and I have been in counseling for my whole life. My mom's a counselor. She's like, "You need to go into counseling. Something needs to happen to you, and we can't do it." So I was familiar with the setting. I did well. I think I want to say that I tried. I started to attend meetings at AA. I did what I was told. I got a sponsor. And it was an amazing experience. I read in the email that one of the things that you guys talk about is the self-sponsorship home group, and there was a fourth one, I can't remember, service. And so I did. I got this sponsor who still tells me to this day she has no idea why she stood up. She's like, all of a sudden, I just noticed that people were shorter than me. And she's like, "I didn't want to be anybody's sponsor." She's like, "I sure as hell didn't want to be your sponsor." And so she sponsored me, and we went through the steps. We started going through the steps, and I kept drinking. And I would call her every day like she told me to, just like the curfew thing. I'd be home on time. I called her every day like she told me to, but I was probably on my second drink. And, you know, I was thinking that probably she didn't know. I'm sure she did know. You know, so I finally... I had some that summer been going into the hospital and out of the hospital because I really didn't know what else to do, and my story is really depressing. I'm sorry, but I didn't know what to do, so I was going to the hospital, and so my mom was coming up each time from Virginia Beach, And so I just remember on this last night, it was a Sunday night, and my sponsor, and she wouldn't mind if I use her name, but Bonnie, I called my mom first, and I was drunk. It was the third time that at least my IOP would know about me getting drunk. And so I called my mom. She's like, I'm done. She's like, I can't do it anymore. And that's a lot for my mom, because my mom and I had a very codependent relationship. So I was like her bloodline. And it was very hard for her to do that. And I had no idea what she was doing and what I was supposed to do, because that was my go-to all the time, 100%. Financially, anything. So I called my sponsor, who never ever answers the phone on a Sunday evening. She will now if she sees me calling. But she, for some reason, picked up, and it was a rainy Sunday evening, and she took me to the hospital. She took me to the hospital, let me back up. When I got my DUI when I was in North Carolina, my last one, my BAC was something astronomical, and it was even worse when I went to the hospital the last time, and it was completely functioning. When somebody came to pick me up, they took me to the hospital instead of the jail. Instead of saying, okay, let's go home or anything like that, the person that picked me up, I looked at them and I was like, we can still make last call. You know, I mean, that's when there's an issue going on. And the police officer even had said, it was the first time I was dating at the time, your girlfriend has a drinking problem. Because there's absolutely no way anybody should be coherent with this much alcohol in their blood system. And so that was that. So then I fast forward. When I went into the hospital, I had like a 0.3 something blood alcohol level. I just wasn't processing anything anymore. So my mom comes up, and the psychiatrist comes in, because I have to do a psych eval. They have to do a psych eval on me. And my sponsor's there, my mom's there, and the psych eval goes, right, have you been trying to stay sober? Da, 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 da. Yes, I have been. You know, we don't see any reason to put you in detox. She's like, you just need to try some more willpower. And my mom was standing there looking at her going like this, the non-alcoholic that she is, and my sponsor's like wanting to jump across the bed and strangle her. You know, there are things like that that come back up in my mind that, you know, I had been trying that. I had tried the, I'll wait till I get home at 5 p.m. and have a drink. I would, you know, I still run, but what if, I would be like, okay, I'm going to have two drinks and then I'm going to go running. Who has two drinks and goes running? You know, and the Kristen drinks, the Kristen 2 were like this big and with this much mixer in it. And, you know, and so... So I had been trying with my willpower, but it never, I always went back to a drink. It was the only thing that relieved pain for me. It was the only thing that helped me not realize what I was. I went 3 months without looking at myself in the mirror. I would fall asleep with a drink next to my bed, and I'd wake up with a drink next to my bed. I'm not lying when I say I drink around the clock. I would drink in the shower. It was better for me to drink in the morning when I was working than not to, because I would have the shakes so bad. It got to the point that I was in bed the majority of the days, and I was starting to have DTs, and I was seeing things. Living by yourself, you know, I mean, I didn't call anybody or anything like that. So my mom and my sponsor are there, and my mom, in complete denial of everything that's going on, basically I'm being told that I'm going away. I'm going away for 28 days. My mom takes me grocery shopping because she wants to make sure that I have food there for the next day. And that's how my family is. She's completely in denial that your daughter is very, very sick and needs to go away. I had started doing my fourth step. I have a decent amount of time. First step I kept going back to any time that I told my sponsor that I had drank. Second and third, I was never religious, was not brought up in a religious home, so they were kind of hard for me to grasp. I know now, I have absolutely seen miracles happen in my life and other people's lives around me, so there is no doubt in my mind that there is something absolutely greater than me, and I feel safe and feel protected by that nowadays, and it's very odd. I can't tell you how it works. I don't even know if I would want to, but... You know, I just happened to not quit right before the miracle, just like my sponsor didn't quit on me right before the miracle. And so I went away. I drank over my fourth step. I wasn't secure in my third step. The steps are there for a reason, in order. I wasn't very, I didn't have third step down, and I had already started working on my fourth step. And looking at all of these things, all these character defects, all this horrible stuff, without having anything else to rely on, I drank. Because I was like, that's disgusting. And that was the last time that I drank, and then I went away. And what happened in those 28 days is I always say God happened. Because God just really did. I wasn't doing the steps. I wasn't doing anything. I mean, I was in a pretty educational setting as far as rehab was concerned, which didn't bother me. But all of a sudden, I just started looking at people, and I would look at these people that were fighting and fighting and fighting, just being in that program, just being there. And I was like, why are you fighting? You know, for once, I firmly believe that it was just my time. You know, it was like a sigh of relief to be there. It was a sigh of relief, I know, for my family. They knew where I was safe and secure. I knew I was safe and secure. I needed to physically be removed away from alcohol and society for however long it took me. So God happened there. And when I came back, you know, I started taking suggestions. I got picked up that afternoon when I came back from rehab and went to a meeting. My sponsor picked me up. I picked up my 30-day chip. I continued. I still had a home group. They welcomed me back. And I was very close with my sponsor. I called her every day to the point that it was like a year or so and some change. And she's like, you know, you don't have to call me every day. And I was like, it's what kept me sober. I've done this program. I have attempted to be involved in this program in many different ways. One was pretty much half-assed. And that was the first time I came in. I completely, when I came back from rehab, threw myself into the program. And I like to talk about the pack. If you're in the jungle or Africa or a pack of antelope, you're running together and you're in the middle. There's a good chance you're not going to get picked off, you know. But if I'm just skirting around on the outskirts, something's waiting, and that's my disease. My disease is just waiting to pick me off. And so I was scared, you know, and that little bit of fear of, you know, I had to go back to the same place and live by myself where I drank myself almost to death. And I was terrified, and I had to change everything in my life. I did way over 90 and 90. I'm probably overachiever. I did at least 180 and 90 days. Was very active in the program, and I stayed very active. And then, you know, it happened for a few years. I went through the steps. I went through the steps, and I tried to listen to my sponsor as much as possible. I have a sponsee right now. God, you have a sense of humor. Because she's me. When I came in here, I was too smart for this program. And that's the sad thing. It's like I had all the educational background, book smarts, everything about alcoholism and this disease, and I knew how it worked, and I was just empty inside, completely empty, because it's not about that. But I was too smart. I was too smart. I didn't want to have anything to do with, you know, being sober. I could do it on my own, and I got cocky. I continued on. My sponsor, my very first sponsor, ended up moving to Alaska. And absolutely broke my heart, so I had to get a new sponsor. And, you know, I'm happy to say that because it was a good experience for me. It was a growth experience. And, you know, I actually didn't end up with the sponsor I have now first. You know, I had to go through some things and find one. But sponsorship is key. And I've had my sponsor that I have now for about 2 years. And I had a hard time talking to her at first. And that causes a problem in the program. I was doing very well, and I started resting on my laurels, as they say. I had probably, I don't know, about my third year sober. I fell in love. Came in, swept me off my feet, wham, bam, no time at all, nothing. And it was somebody that didn't live around me, and it was somebody that lived in the country. And next thing you know, I was being swept off, and I was moving. And everything I knew and everything that I am was in Richmond. I got sober in Richmond. And that's my home. And, you know, I was like, I can do this. I can do this. And it wasn't a healthy relationship. I'm not here to say that he's one of us, but maybe he is. And from what I understand, he was dry the whole time that we were together. And so, therefore, that makes for two dry alcoholics. That's not very, very, very good. I attempted to get a home group down there, and that didn't work. I kept my sponsor, who I talked to occasionally. I got engaged, and I would meet her once a week in Richmond at the meeting at my home group now. And one of the reasons why I went to that home group was because not many people that I used to associate with would go to that home group because I was embarrassed. So I met with her once a week, and that was basically all the program that I had. I had not given up on God, but, you know, I wasn't praying like I used to. I was strictly relying on my will, completely and totally. And, you know, there's no kidding when it says that anything you put before your sobriety, you will lose. Absolutely. Whether it's meant to be lost and it's good to be lost, because me going through what I went through is the greatest thing that ever happened to me in my life now. Now, it's taken me a year to stand up here and say that. But I had to, you know, I put some things in front of my sobriety, and they were taken away from me. One night, my relationship wasn't good. I was away from people that I knew. I was on 300 acres of land and moving from the fan. And so one night I was not getting, I guess, the attention that I needed and whatnot, and I found myself with a drink in front of me. And, I mean, there were obvious steps that went through that. But the thing was is that I was thinking that I could get attention because this person knew that I was an alcoholic. And putting a drink in front of me, actually thinking about risking my sobriety, the one thing that I cherish and value the most in my life, would get me attention. That didn't go the way that I wanted it to. I did not drink, though. So I absolutely know that there is something that is greater than me because I am an alcoholic, and I want that drink in my body, and I could not pick it up. I could stare at it. I could stare at it all I wanted, but I was frozen for some reason. There was something between me and that drink, and there's been something that has helped me along because it's been a painful year. It's been a really painful year for me, but it's been growth, and that's the cool thing. And I can look back on all of this, and I haven't drank. You know, I've gone through every life big event besides getting married and having a child this year. And, you know, I've done it sober. And it's a pretty cool thing. And I didn't have any, when I came back to, I moved back to Richmond. I moved back to the fan. I got involved again. My sponsor and I talk on a regular basis. And lo and behold, what do you know, life is good. You know, all because of simple steps. I mean, it really is, and, you know, I don't really know how much more to say because it is a simple program, and I am a complicated person, and I want to complicate things. But, you know, I just went on a, we were talking before, I just went on a trip. My best friend was in New York City. I went up there, and I woke up one morning, and I was with my boyfriend, and I said, and he's in the program, and I said, I have that feeling of wanting more, and I get that occasionally. I'm not craving a drink. I'm not craving drugs, but a cigarette's not good enough, and coffee ain't good enough. And there's something more that I'm needing. And I looked at him, and I started telling him, I said, we need to go to a meeting. And he said, absolutely, you know. And we found one. Of course, there's God knows how many in the city. And it was funny because when I walked into that meeting, it was a woman that was sharing her story, and God knows it was exactly what I wanted to hear or what I needed to hear. She was talking about me and that wanting more was me not having acceptance for that day. And so she was talking, her whole spiel was on acceptance. And it's very weird. I find that, you know, things like that are in my, I mean, God works in my life. I call them God things. And I happened to make it even more weird. I happened to go up afterwards and thank her. And she said, where are you from again? And I said, Richmond. She goes, my sister lives in Richmond, and I've been to tons of meetings down there in the fan. And I was just like, I mean, what's the chance of that happening? When I came back, I didn't have any sponsees. There's an alumni association with where I went to rehab, and they got in touch with me and said, there's a young lady coming back to your area. You know, would you mind just introducing her to meetings and everything? And that's all I did. And I told her parts of my story. And she's like, I want what you have. And for somebody to say that to me, just absolutely to this day, just still, nobody wanted anything that I had before. And I don't blame them. But she said that. And, you know, there's been a couple times that I've gotten to say to her, well, if you want what I have, you got to do what I did. And, you know, it's not work. It's just willingness. You know, it's willing for me to take simple steps, to do the things that people before me have done. You know, I mean, seriously, if you want what somebody has, find out how they did it. And, you know, working a program, being in a home group, having a sponsor, those are all the fundamental easy things, I think, about the program. Now, alcohol is a symptom of my problem. I am my problem. And I'll tell you, working those steps helps me get through any problem that I have in the day to day. It does not have to be alcohol related one bit. And I don't even know where I heard it from, but it's so true. And whenever I'm stuck in a really, really big dilemma, predicament, life crisis, whatever, it's always the bigger the problem, the smaller the step. You know, if I'm in this huge, huge, huge whirlwind of things, you know, I've got to look and see that I probably am powerless over it, you know, and what I need to do. And I work through the steps. Second and third, I give it over. You know, I mean, it's just that's helped me. That's helped me. I've had to look at my feet. Some days I can't make it 24 hours, you know, not drinking, not just because of me. And so I'll start my day over. I'll go into work. I'll shut my door. You know, if it's the middle of the day and, you know, it's usually me. I'm usually squirrely. I'll shut the door. I'll say a prayer and I'll start my day over again. Open up the door and it's amazing how it works. Yeah, so I've done this program. I hate saying done. There's got to be a better way to say it. I've tried to do this program many different ways, and you know, I keep going back to one that works, and that's all of the things that this group talks about and puts emphasis on. And you know, there's a triangle, and without one piece of that triangle, a triangle can't stay up together. And so those are the things that keep me sober today, and those are the things that you know, I look forward to tomorrow. Thank you for listening to my story. Yeah. Thank you.